If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, everyone, this is Seth Meyers, and you're listening to the Late Night Podcast Summer Friday Edition.
All summer long, our Summer Friday series brings you fully original content produced just for the Late Night Podcast. On this episode, you'll hear a new edition of Midterm Cram, where late night staffers Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher interview former FBI Special Agent Asha Rangappa about the threat of Russian interference in the upcoming elections. Plus, some summer reading recommendations from special guests. Now, let's get to the show.
Even though Late Night is off this week, we're still thinking about politics as the midterms rapidly approach. To catch you up, let's go over to two of our staffers, Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher, as they unpack what's going on in a new edition of Midterm Cram.
Hi, this is Henry Melcher, a producer at Late Night. So you are about to hear a conversation between myself, Sal Gentile, supervising writer of A Closer Look, and Asha Rangappa, a former FBI special agent. We talk about the Mueller investigation, the Manafort trial, and Russian efforts to influence our midterms. But first, we wanted to let you know that we recorded the conversation before some pretty big news broke. The Manafort verdict, Michael Cohen pleading guilty, and Microsoft uncovering new Russian hacking efforts. So we thought it would be helpful just to mention that up top. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did.
All right, Henry, I'm going to read your fact sheet here. And here's the thing. As usual with your fact sheets, it's very helpful because we just had a great conversation with Asha.
It was a fascinating conversation with Asha.
We were both very nervous to talk to somebody with an impressive background like that.
Yeah. So I wrote down her background on my fact sheet because there were too many pieces of her bio that I was scared I was going to forget.
Yeah. First of all, when you hear the words Yale and counterintelligence this often in the same resume, right off the bat, it makes you very nervous to talk to that person because of how impressive they are.
Yeah. Her resume is absolutely incredible. I just loved our conversation with her. It was such an interesting conversation because we talked about the Manafort trial, which is one of the major political stories now. But then we also talked about how Russia's trying to influence our midterm elections. Yeah. And she breaks it down in really helpful, productive ways.
Yeah, because we have this weird thing looming over politics right now, which is that the president's former campaign chairman is on trial right now for tax fraud and money laundering, which is in itself crazy. Even if Obama's campaign chairman had been on trial for tax fraud and money laundering and had nothing to do with colluding with a foreign adversary, as we all know, this goes without saying, Fox News would be screaming impeachment. It would be a massive thing that looms over politics. But in addition to the specific charges in the Manafort trial, it's not explicitly in the sort of like day-to-day aspect of the trial, but it's looming over it, which is what, if anything, does this have to do with the possibility that the Trump campaign, the very likely possibility that the Trump campaign colluded in some way, they obviously attempted to collude with a foreign adversary to interfere in the election. And Asha does a great job of explaining how it's related in some way. Broadly speaking, there's a lot of details, specifically new details that have been unearthed in the trial that explain a very likely, it's speculative at this point, but a very likely motive for why Paul Manafort might have wanted to get in with the Trump campaign and why he might have wanted to leverage his association with Trump in his relationships with Russian intelligence officers and oligarchs who are tied to Russian intelligence. I mean, he had like a $10 million loan from this guy, Oleg Deripaska, and he's not the kind of guy you want to owe $10 million to. And on top of that, Manafort, he owes a massive amount of money to this like oligarch with ties to Russian intelligence, and he wants to get into the political spotlight. He wants to be in the most talked about thing, a presidential campaign in the country. He wants to be on TV every day as Trump's campaign chairman. So something's going on there. There's a reason why he's doing that. And Asha's great at explaining
She's
what's the possible.
Good.
And yeah. Look, we may never connect those dots, which is something we discussed with Asha as well. You know, who knows? We don't know what Mueller's going to do. Maybe he'll write a report saying this is what Manafort did in exchange for that, but we have no idea.
Yeah.
And so we're in this weird sort of moment where we see all these circumstantial things. It's easy to speculate about how they're related, and we just have to wait and see if they ever will be connected or not.
Right.
Also, the degree to which her background as a counterintelligence officer is so fascinating in shedding light on. I think everyone can relate to this, which is it just seems so fantastical and crazy what's going on right now. Yeah. I mean,
even to a former counterintelligence officer,
yes.
It seems fantastical and crazy, which she's very honest about.
Yes. You imagine having to catch people doing like hand drops in the park in the middle of the night, whatever. And instead you have like the president on Twitter saying like, yeah, I tried to collude, but that's
right.
Not a crime, which it is. And you've got all these weird details in the Manafort trial that are suspicious right off the bat. And so I'm curious, like, even to a counterintelligence officer, how crazy is what is happening right now?
So we talk about the efforts thus far, and there certainly have been some, and essentially why they want to interfere, how those goals aren't just for this current moment. They are kind of a larger generational goal of undermining American democracy. We talk about that, which is super depressing, but like kind of entertaining. Like it's like a pretty lively, very lively, depressing conversation. For depressing conversations about undermining our democracy, I would say it's like pretty lively.
I mean, we all just have to adjust our lively, entertaining meter to everything has a tinge of depression to it now.
Yeah.
Like there's never going to be, that's just how the world is right now.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, we should probably just shut up and just get to it.
Yeah, let's just get to Asha.
Here's Asha. Welcome back. We are here with Asha Rangappa. She is a former FBI special agent assigned to New York's Counterintelligence Division, former associate dean at Yale Law School. Currently, she is a senior lecturer at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, and she is a legal and national security analyst on CNN. Asha, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we want to talk to you about the current state of Russian interference on the midterms, but we think it's also important to talk about the major Russian story that's going on right now. As we are recording this, it is August 10th. But that story is, of course, the Manafort trial, part of the larger Mueller investigation. Sal, I know you want to ask some questions about what we've seen in the trial thus far.
I want to ask broadly because you have so much experience. We spent a lot of time writing about this trial because it's in the news and it's so extraordinary and so fantastical in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
From your experience in counterintelligence, how crazy is this?
What's unusual here is that typically counterintelligence investigations, which what they do is the counterintelligence of the FBI monitors foreign intelligence activity in the United States. They figure out who the spies are, what they're doing, and how to stop them. They're using sensitive techniques and methods. They're using very sensitive human sources, electronic sources, and typically these spies are under diplomatic cover. So what's unusual here is that rarely do counterintelligence cases ever find their way into the inside of a courtroom, because even if you uncover crimes, you don't necessarily want to prosecute someone, even if you can, because then you have to reveal how you know what you know, and that helps your adversary up their game. So that's kind of the big picture here, is that what investigators discovered in the course of doing their counterintelligence investigation into Russia uncovered these massive financial crimes, which they are now prosecuting. What this tells me, the amount of money that's involved in this case that was coming from Ukrainian sources connected to Russian intelligence for his work working on the pro-Russia, for Manafort's work working on the pro-Russia Ukrainian campaign. And then the fact that he ended up in dire financial straits and owing tons of money to Russian oligarchs, which is never a good thing when you're valuing your life.
Yeah.
And that then he shows up on the doorstep of the Trump campaign willing to work for free. Now, the guy was buying, what was it, $20,000
ostrich jacket, yes.
Somebody was buttering his bread, okay? And he is there in this campaign essentially beholden to foreign interests. So what I am seeing here is unfolding in this. People say, well, this is not about collusion. What I see is exactly the recruitment path and the leverage that Russian intelligence used to get this guy on board, hook him, and then hold a sword of Damocles over his head, which is the position he was in when he was in the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. And so then we need to ask ourselves, what was he doing behind the scenes for Russia?
I think that's so fascinating. It's such an interesting thing about this trial. First of all, I imagine counterintelligence officers doing all the things you imagine counterintelligence officers doing in your head, which is that they have these long telephoto lenses and they have these black and white photos of people in the park handing things off. And then it's so fascinating to imagine that at some point somebody was like, he's got a $20,000 ostrich jacket. Something weird is going on here. What you just laid out seems like a very convincing narrative that the evidence is already there to explain what Manafort's motivations might have been and his links to Russian intelligence and all these oligarchs who he was very much in hock to and possibly had the power to end his life at some point. And so it's this weird feeling of waiting. We have all these data points that he owed money to Oleg Deripaska and these shady gangsters and stuff like that. And that provides a possible motivation, but we're still waiting for those dots to be connected. So do you think at some point, and this is purely speculation, that there will ever be a point at which, whether it's the Mueller investigation or anything else, where we will definitively find out, oh yeah, he did this thing in exchange for that?
It's possible.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. And right. Here's why. You know, I think you've hit the nail on the head, is that, you know, the way I describe this to a lot of people is a counterintelligence investigation is like the whole movie. And what you see in a criminal trial are only specific scenes, okay? Because you can only charge particular conduct that may have crossed the threshold. You know the part where he's doing the dead drop and, you know, negotiating with oligarchs. I mean, if it doesn't actually, is not relevant to bank fraud, it's not going to make its way into that evidentiary presentation. So there are a couple of obstacles. So one I mentioned is, does Mueller want to write a report where he lays out this whole movie so that people aren't just looking at individual scenes? They're able to see all the characters and plot lines. Right. There is a trade-off to that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this is very highly classified. He may not want to tip his hand or put sources in danger or whatever. But I think, you know, that's one way is a report by Mueller, because I don't think any criminal charges will ever lay out the whole thing. But he is sort of doing this by charging Russians.
Right.
When you look at the indictments against the Russian nationals, both in the social media indictment, which was in the fall, or was it early?
It was 2002. It just, honestly, we have no concept of time anymore.
The reason why, where they did the Facebook campaigns, and then the very recent ones against the GRU military officers, he's not expecting to get those people into court and to try these cases. But what he is doing is using the indictment as a way to lay out in a public way, almost like a report, and a narrative of exactly what Russia was doing. So laying out some of this background story. How we're going to, you know, connect the specific role that these people were playing. I mean, if you have the knowledge of, you know, some of the how these intelligence services work, you can piece it together. But to the layperson, I think it would need to be put out in some kind of report.
You worked under Robert Mueller.
Yes.
At the FBI. You probably can't say much, but like, what's the guy like? And let's say you're being investigated by Robert Mueller, hypothetically, how worried should you be?
Yeah, so let's be clear. I worked under Robert Mueller, meaning that he was the director of the FBI when I went in. He handed me my credentials when I graduated from Quantico. Robert Mueller's graduation speech to my class at Quantico was basically, there are 60,000 other people ready to take your spot, so if you don't like this job, you can leave.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's no nonsense. You know what I mean? He was kind of like, here's your job. Yeah. You just took an oath to uphold the Constitution. Love it or leave it. Goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, my sense of him was that he was incredibly no nonsense. You know, he instituted a lot of policies that, you know, kind of were really about the Bureau meeting the challenges in a post 9/11 that I think there were many older agents were not happy with, because it was fundamentally changing kind of the priority and culture of the Bureau for the better, in my opinion. He was very proactive. He has long-term vision, and he helped the FBI weather a very difficult time when the FBI was partly left holding the bag after 9/11, along with many other intelligence agencies. So I think he is no nonsense. He can see what needs to be done to achieve you know, his objective. And I don't think he is fazed at all by Trump's tweets. I don't think he is worried about getting fired. You know, I think he's booby-trapped this investigation, so it is going to continue no matter what. Yeah. I say he's four steps ahead of everybody.
Explain more of what you mean by that, what, in the sense that it's booby-trapped, that it would continue even if something like cataclysmic happened, if like Trump decided to fire him or Rosenstein is impeached or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that by design of how the FBI operates. This is a creation of Hoover. You know, Hoover worked in the Library of Congress before he became director of the FBI. So there is a very methodical kind of cross-referencing system within the FBI of cases. So, you know, the Mueller investigation, as we call it, consists of tens, maybe even up to 100. We don't know how many different, you know, spider webs there are of cases that are probably kind of branching out to many other divisions. I am guessing hundreds of thousands of pages of evidence have been collected through various means. There's intelligence that's been shared and documented, everything in a case file, human sources, whatever. You know, there is too much in the system. The train has left the station. And you could even burn down the Hoover building and all of that would still remain and somebody would pick up the pieces and continue it. But I think we are already seeing that he is farming out some cases to, you know, individual districts. So outside of his kind of narrow parameters, he sent the Cohen case to the Southern District, for example. He's also sending some FARA investigations of Ukrainian agents. Yeah. That is kind of... It's kind of blockchaining the investigation into different places so that they don't, you know, even if his is quashed, which I think would be hard to do, those will still survive. And finally, I have no doubt that he is sharing his information with the relevant attorney generals in states where people may have committed state crimes. And, you know, that would... Of course, it would be up to the states, but if they had that evidence, they could pick up the pieces and continue with prosecutions if they so choose.
That is so fascinating that he's sort of methodically sort of spreading the seeds of the investigation so they can live on beyond him if by any chance something crazy happens.
You know, and I mean, that could, there could be many motivations for that. He does have limited resources. He has a limited budget that, you know, the special counsel regulations give him. So he may not have the bandwidth to, I mean, it may be just so big that he's just like, I can't do it. And
which it would be very relatable, by the way. If even Robert Mueller is like, there's just too much here, guys.
You know, and it could be that there are things that he may uncover that are outside of, you know, his focus. Right. So, you know, there could be a number of reasons that he is doing that. But, you know, the upshot of it is that it means that he is not the person that will make the investigation live on.
Yeah. I also just want to say, I think it's so funny, the idea that, as you mentioned, he's booby-trapped the investigation, because nobody is more likely to fall for a booby trap than Donald Trump. If Donald Trump, like, saw a cheeseburger on a string, he would chase it until his head got stuck in a box. Like, that's what would happen. And so it's so funny to me that Donald Trump absolutely would fall for a booby trap.
To have these two personalities is amazing. This no-nonsense Robert Mueller
it
on one end, and then
very
Donald
cinematic.
Trump
it's crazy.
It is. Yeah.
It is amazing how far-reaching this could all be and this, the many aspects of it. Well, speaking of that, I do want to move to the midterms.
Yeah.
So we're talking about 2016. There's been a lot of articles and, you know, some talk about what Russia is doing in terms of the midterms. New York Times posted a piece on July 27th that so far it looks like, I'm reading from the Times, state-sponsored Russian hackers appear far more interested this year in demonstrating they can disrupt the American electric utility grid than the midterm elections, which is terrifying. But there have been these two attempts to infiltrate the online accounts of two Senate Democrats up for re-election. One is Claire McCaskill, the other we don't know. And then last week, Bill Nelson said that from Florida, Russian operatives penetrated some of Florida's voter registration systems. We don't kind of have confirmation about that. And overall, the Times piece does also say that maybe they're just waiting till closer to the election to do more, to interfere more with our midterms. What is your sense of the Russian efforts right now to get involved in our midterms? And what are they doing? What do they look like, those efforts?
Yeah. Okay, so let's zoom back for a second. And I think it's important for people to understand what we are talking about when we say Russian interference, because there's a lot of different things that I think get conflated. I would say that if we look back at 2016, there were four different fronts that Russia was working on. One of them is hacking and intrusion. hacking into email accounts to weaponize personal information that can be embarrassing to particular candidates, for example, intrusion into voting machines, which is what you just described. However, there were other fronts as well. So you have the disinformation campaign that is, you know, trying to basically putting out propaganda to distort how people view candidates unconsciously, changing their attitudes. Then you had the campaign contribution angle where, you know, which is something that Mueller is investigating, using straw men or organizations to funnel foreign contributions into elections, which is illegal. And then we finally have foreign influence. This is where this Russian spy, the redhead Maria Butina, is like kind of gallivanting around the NRA and sleeping with people. But, you know, the idea here is to is more overt. It's using people to essentially lobby, you know, to get people who are in positions to make policy change their views. So we have all of these fronts. The hacking front is one of them. So we can talk about that first if that's sure. what you want to focus on. But I think it's just important to have the big picture.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people say hacking when they mean everything. And sometimes people, you know, there are different goals and they're kind of all working in concert. And this is what we collectively refer to as active measures.
Right. They hacked our election has become absolutely the shorthand. So it's incredibly helpful to have that broken apart.
And the sort of parallel is so, and the way you've laid it out is so interesting because on the one hand, you have these like covert actions that are very hard to detect. And for people who are digesting them, very hard to know where this information is coming from. And then on the other hand, you have Maria Butina, who's literally like getting drunk and telling people, I'm a Russian spy.
Right.
It's so funny, the differences in tradecraft.
Yes.
Like, what do you see as the most kind of impactful or which efforts do you think these Russian state operatives are most kind of excited about employing or utilizing in the U.S.?
I think they're pretty excited about all of them, you know, and they it's like throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks. And, you know, a lot of it seems to be sticking. So I think they're just going to keep doing what works. You know, so let's talk about the hacking intrusion, okay, and why and what the problem is here and what the issue is. So the Constitution leaves the management or the kind of execution of elections up to the states. Okay, so this is a federalism issue. So this is really up to the states. They do their own thing. Department of Homeland Security can provide things like advice or guidance on how, or you know, test their infrastructure to look for vulnerabilities. But it's really up to states to request them. So when you're looking at election security in terms of voting systems, it really depends on the state. And what you have to go back to is Bush v. Gore. Okay, because after Bush v. Gore, remember Hanging Chads?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like Hanging Chads is like, it should be the name of a rom-com. Or something.
It's just like two Chads trying to make it work in the big city. Hanging on by a thread.
And actually accidentally stumble into a Supreme Court case.
Exactly.
That steals an election from.
Exactly. So, okay. So Hanging Chads. The Help America Vote Act was passed in 2002, and what this did was it offered $4 billion to upgrade election security. And what this did was it was kind of like the gold rush for voting system companies to come up with new like voting systems. So many states moved to, and I want to get direct recording electronic machines. And these are things like touchscreen, you know, voting, et cetera. The issue here is that these all require software. And, you know, some states are using quite outdated kind of voting software. So for one example, the state of Georgia, there's a lawsuit right now against the governor there for, you know, not upgrading or changing their voting systems. But that the Georgia voting system is using 2013 Windows software for which there are no longer any updates. And just imagine like how many times your own computer updates every year, every week. Okay. So they're not putting the patches in. So they're very vulnerable systems.
Oh,
and the worst part is that some of these voting systems don't leave a paper trail or one that has you know, kind of a record of how people voted, so that in the event of a recount, you can kind of accurately go back. Or if they leave a paper trail, it's like a barcode or something that, you know, you can't, as a voter, really verify that that is who you voted for. So the vulnerability here is that states that are using this, and what we know about how the Russians hacked is that they used actually pretty unsophisticated hacking tools. Like, they were like spear phishing for passwords and stuff like that, that they don't have to really work very hard. So, you know, that's where we are. It's really up to the states to do this. Some states are not doing it. It leaves people without a great way in some of these states to verify their vote. And really, the way to protect against this is to go to paper ballots.
Yeah, it is amazing. We're having a very kind of high-tech conversation about what the FBI can do in these investigations, how Russia's infiltrating the elections. And it seems like the answer is a very low-tech solution, which is just go back to paper ballots. So on July 27th, the same day of this New York Times article, the White House put out this statement. I want to get your reaction to this statement. The White House said, the president has made it clear that his administration will not tolerate foreign interference in our elections from any nation state or other malicious actors. Do you think the White House will not tolerate it? Is the White House doing enough or anything in terms of stopping more Russian interference this season?
Well, the White House, I think, just got rid of all of their cyber officials or the people who kind of develop cyber policy. So that's a bit of a problem. They also, the White House appears to be contradicting or not really giving any direction to our intelligence communities on how to proceed proactively against our adversaries. So that's a problem. And I think the worst part, and this kind of goes to the other prongs of the active measures that I described earlier, you know, these voting vulnerabilities, that these are short-term threats. In other words, they're very specific to elections. But we have longer-term threats in terms of disinformation and foreign influence, because these are actually changing people's behaviors and attitudes, not just towards policies towards Russia, but about each other. There's a lot of divisive rhetoric, and this is what Russia is exploiting, right? Divisions in class, on charged social issues. And I think one of the most damaging things that the White House is doing, and that contradicts this idea that they don't want Russia to attack, is that they are echoing those same messages and amplifying them and giving them more power, which then helps Russia kind of in its efforts to sow chaos and distrust and division within our democracy.
So what do you, okay, so say we can't stop a lot of this interference, which it seems like we're just not capable of or willing to. How do we talk to people about believing less of it, believing less of this propaganda, this divisive, these divisive messages we get? How do we, if we're going to see it, how do we talk about it? How do we understand it?
No, it's hard because we're right in the middle of it, right? Huh. So I think short of everyone getting off social media, which isn't going to happen, but I think that's part of it, is that we're in these echo chambers where these things ricochet. So we're increasingly living in alternative realities, like actual alternative factual realities. Like everybody doesn't sit down and watch the same 6 p.m. newscast anymore, right? So we're not operating off a shared set of facts. I think we need more civic engagement, either in real time or, I don't know, bring back Schoolhouse Rock or something. Because, you know, I mean, 46...
I did not think you were going to answer that question that way, but I think that's right.
No, I think there needs to be an updated Schoolhouse Rock.
For sure.
And, you know, 46% of Republicans think that it would be okay for Trump to ban the media.
Yeah.
Right.
At the very least, an episode that's like, don't believe most memes that you see. Like, because it's crazy how so unsophisticated some
they're
of the memes
so
are.
So bad. Like, I know. The they're so was, crude. Yeah.
The one that was like Satan arm wrestling with Jesus, and Jesus is like, I want Trump to win. And Satan's like, no, I want Hillary to win.
It's but it's like, psychological warfare, right? Because what they have realized is that images and memes are actually much more powerful in affecting how people, you know, affecting people's beliefs than actual information, than a big diatribe about, you know, why Hillary is bad or something that is more effective.
I mean, the frustrating thing about a lot of this is, a lot of it is our structural things that we have to solve ourselves, as you've mentioned, independent of Russian interference attempts. So we can definitely do as much as we can to stop those. But like, a lot of it is like structural flaws in our politics, like our
structural polarization that happens, asymmetric polarization, I would say, like mostly on the right. And another thing, as you mentioned, are not having a common sort of like reality or public spaces like Facebook that are very easily infiltrated by this kinds of things. And those are the public domains in which the political dialogue happens. And we have to figure out, like, is that the best way for us to structure our political dialogue? Like, is it good that most people access most of the information they get through the world from the
on
world
social
through
media.
Exactly through Facebook specifically,
no,
or
it's
Twitter
a problem.
Or whatever. Yeah, so it's so unwieldy. It has a lot of these like parts. A lot of it is Russian interference, and other parts are just like, you know, how do we reorganize the internet, which is like a crazy thing.
And I think people,
Asha, how do we reorganize?
Please tell me how to reorganize the internet.
You know, I think that also people need to understand that. For some of these things, particularly with disinformation, there are very limited tools the government has. So short of regulating the social media platforms, which, you know, they could do, a number of cases that I did as an FBI agent doing counterintelligence cases were cases called perception management cases. So these are propaganda cases. And they're incredibly hard to investigate because we have a First Amendment.
Yeah.
Even when you discover that foreign agents are putting out propaganda, you have very few remedies. We don't, as a government, shut down outlets. We don't shut down, you know, news. The only way to neutralize it is to make the source of the information available to people so that they can evaluate it in full context. Right. So, you know, the government isn't going to stop this aspect of it.
Yeah.
So it definitely does come down to how do we as consumers start to change our own behaviors and how we take in this information.
Right.
I think that's a fascinating thing you mentioned, which is that in a lot of cases, the most we can expect is that whether it's the Mueller investigation or the government broadly speaking, they just tell us the story of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't expect necessarily that all these like GRU officers are going to, we certainly can't expect that they're going to be thrown in jail and that the meme makers will stop and there won't be any more memes like making fun of Democrats and stuff. And that like Mueller, hopefully he can just like give us a report to tell us what happened, that the government can maybe make clear as much as possible that we're getting as much information about where all this information is coming from. And then people have to have responsibility to some degree for taking action, which is a whole bigger political question, whether it's evaluating the source of information or, for example, if Mueller makes recommendations, then the rest of the solution is largely political. Like, there has to be a political accountability mechanism of, like, people have to decide, we want to impeach the president or we want to do the X, Y, or Z thing. So, you know, that seems like in a lot of cases the remedy lies, and it's absolutely the case that, like, hopefully if there are crimes committed, as is the case with Manafort, they will be prosecuted and people will go to jail for breaking the law. But like in a lot of cases, the remedies are political and we have to do
that's
it ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And the other, you know, just on the other front with the foreign influence, a little self-awareness can go a long way. So newsflash to 50 and 60 something year old dudes that, you know, when like, you know, a cute 20 something Russian shows up and wants to go to a Styx concert with you, she probably really doesn't think you're that interesting or attractive, and she might be a spy. Yeah. Okay? Because, you know, that's the other piece of this is that, you know, you're watching this and you're like, really?
Yeah. Also, when she gets drunk and is like, I love to spy for Russia and I love being a spy.
Believer!
That whole story is so funny. And that's another thing, by the way, that I mean to ask you, like, have you ever seen anything like this in your career? Because there's all these like recorded conversations of her just being like, yeah, this guy sucks. Like, I can't, like, she's sleeping with this guy. What was his name? Paul Erickson? This sort of like Republican operative guy, like on the fringes of Republican politics, involved with the NRA, and she's sleeping with him and has a relationship with him many years her senior, and
is complaining about
is secretly complaining about this guy sucks. Like, I can't believe I have to sleep with this guy. Like, it's so lame. Like,
well, you know what's? I think what that drives home is that this is a win-win for Russia, whether they get caught or not. If they don't get caught, they get to just execute their nefarious plans and, you know, watch our democracy implode. But when they do get caught and when this comes out, they still succeed in casting doubt on the legitimacy of our institutions and things like electoral outcomes. In other words, they can afford to be sloppy and be overt because, you know, if they poke around in the voting infrastructure, for example, and they're not very, you know, coy about it, and they get caught, everybody then is going to doubt at the election afterwards, wait, is this a true result?
Right.
And that still achieves Russia's goals. Because what they want is ultimately for us to become apathetic and disillusioned by our own democracy. Because then they can point to it and say, see, it doesn't really work and it's a sham anyway.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a little bit more about this goals aspect of it. I feel like that's kind of been lost in the larger conversation about Russian interference, hacking, intrusion, all these different words. Well, how do you kind of understand the goals beyond just kind of trying to sow discord? We saw Russian interference in 2016. We're seeing it right now.
Well, we are the number one enemy for Russia. And what they understand post-Cold War, what Putin understands, is they are not going to beat us economically or technologically or militarily, but what they can do is make us implode. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incredibly important to understand that when you do a covert action, what you are looking for are ways to exploit your enemy's vulnerabilities. You know, their goal is really to cast doubt. I mean, all of these things, and fake press, enemy of the people. They want us to just actually not know what to believe anymore. We don't know which way is up, to wonder if the FBI is corrupt, to wonder if you can trust the judges, if you can trust outcomes of elections, because eventually then people just kind of give up and they're not really caring about, you know, we lose the shared trust and values, which is, I think, very hard to erode, but once you do it, it's also very hard to get back. And for them, that is a huge long-term win.
Well, that's so funny too. The life of a Russian intelligence officer that you've described so far, like putting aside their like nefarious and odious purposes, like it sounds like a great gig. You don't have to work that hard. Whatever you do wins. Like you succeed
exactly.
No matter what.
I got caught. And we won.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, boss, I got caught. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Well,
this was an incredibly informative and really enjoyable conversation about Russia interference with our election.
Depressing, but I think we can all be comforted in knowing that Robert Mueller will solve everything.
Yeah. No nonsense.
Or that Schoolhouse Rock might make a comeback.
That's the takeaway.
If we can get enough support.
Schoolhouse Rock, that's just about don't believe dumb memes or go to a protest.
It is such a
no more memes.
If a red-haired woman shows up at your political convention and she says, I'm a Russian spy, like just believe her. Yeah.
Arsha, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Here at Late Night, we love books and authors, and throughout the summer, we've been presenting some summer reading recommendations from our guests. Without further ado, here are some books to check out.
Hey, what's up? It's Awkwafina, and I just want to recommend a book to you. It's called Crazy Rich Asians, and there's also two more, China Rich Girlfriend and Rich People Problems. Sorry, I don't know why I'm saying it like that, but anyway, read them and enjoy. Okay, bye.
Hi, it's Lester Holt from NBC Nightly News. I just finished reading, I love crime mysteries, and probably everybody in the world's read this but me, but The General's Daughter, Nelson DeMille. Really good read. Had a little downtime. A lot of travel here, actually, recently, and it was a great airplane read. So if you like a good mystery, I know it became a movie, and you may have seen the movie, and you think you know it. I'd forgotten the movie, so it was like watching it fresh. But anyway, The General's Daughter.
My name is Phoebe Robinson, actor, comedian, a whole bunch of things. The book I'm currently reading right now is James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. It is some of the best writing I've ever read. It's very moving. It's very powerful. He writes about race in a beautiful way. Also, like, humanity, which is such a, like, a universal experience. So I really, really love it. And it makes me also be like, why am I a writer? But it's really good, so everyone should buy it and read it.
Hi, everybody. This is Viet Thanh Nguyen, author of The Refugees. I have a book recommendation for you. It's Reading with Patrick, a teacher, a student, and a life-changing friendship, written by Michelle Kuo. She graduated from Harvard and wanted to do something meaningful with her life, so she went to one of the poorest neighborhoods in the United States in Arkansas and became a teacher of many disadvantaged, low-income students. And the book is about her relationship with these students, her relationship with teaching, her convictions about what it means to try to change the world through teaching and the difficulties of doing that, and in particular, her relationship and friendship with a young man named Patrick and what happens to him when, eventually, he goes to jail. It's a meaningful, moving book about some of the most difficult problems we face in the United States, but also a book that's really, really compelling, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Hi, this is Jake Tapper from CNN, and I just finished a great book. It hasn't come out yet. It's an early copy. The guy's name is John Ward, who wrote it, W-A-R-D, and he wrote a book called Camelot's End, Kennedy, Carter, and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. And it's about when Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter in 1980. And it's just a fascinating portrait of two incredibly complicated, ambitious, flawed politicians and a fight that obviously both of them ultimately ended up losing. Kennedy lost the primary, Carter lost the election. And just about when two ambitious men go at each other. And I couldn't put it down. I read it. It's a history book, but I read it in like 2 days. And it's fascinating.
Thanks for listening to the Late Night Podcast. Check back next week for another Summer Friday edition.
If you like what you hear, tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they listen to podcasts. And be sure to check out Late Night with Seth Meyers on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.